Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th. And it's making me feel joy. Woo! And sadness. Oh. And anger. Definitely some disgust.
Rose!
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
The songs that I make are like little diary entries, and maybe putting them out there in the world, like on a record or whatever, is a way of feeling less alone. You know, I like to describe it as like putting out my E.T. finger. You know how E.T. has that glowing finger and like is reaching out for a connection.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
I very rarely play music with people that I don't like personally or get a very bad vibe from, you know? So I feel like it's such a social thing. And you can kind of instinctively tell whether you would click with a person, you know, in a friend style way. I feel like same as music, you know, it's all wrapped in to one for me. So I think if the magic is there with a conversation, then the magic can be there with playing music together usually.
It's the downfall of many bands.
That's why I play solo. No, I do play a lot of solo.
But you know, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Music, though, is a conversation, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's done the right way. But, you know, in The Cure, I was the person who was in charge of all the, you know, electronics and stuff. And right. You know, the rest of them were Luddites. You know, if you can't hit it or bang it, they don't want to know, you know. So
I'm kind of that way.
I had a dragon kicking and screaming into the 21st century, you know, a little bit.
Where do your ex-colleagues send all the nasty mail, lol? That's not true. It's not true what he said. No, he was telling lies. It wasn't that. It's not that way at all. I was the one who did all the programming. That's what happens in bands, you see. That's what happens. You meet on these magic moments. You all meet up and go, oh, you're great. Should we form a band? You go, brilliant. And you get down the pub and you have a great night. And it's all good for about a year, so I'm told.
Uh-oh.
If you're lucky.
And then it's a bit like a relationship. It goes up and down. And they might come up and you might go down and it might come back together and then it gets brilliant again, you know. But it really is. It goes in phases. And then somebody might, you know, leave or somebody might get kicked out or whatever. But I think it is. It's just like any other commitment. You know,
some things do work in the long term, but there's a kind of maybe other things fall by the wayside.
Yeah, mm-hmm. True. It's true. When I was 14 or 15 and would read, you know, in the Melody Maker about bands breaking up, I'd think, why? Why do they do that? That's, you know, what's wrong with them? They make great music, you know. And it wasn't until I got into the whole thing and realized, oh, yeah, you know.
And they all look so good together. And obviously, and their hair is so brilliant. Mary, have you got close to being in an ensemble for a lengthy time?
Not for a lengthy time, but like for 2 years, I toured with Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth with his acoustic band. We made a record, Demolish Thoughts, together, and then I was touring with them. And I don't know, I loved it. I definitely romanticize bands still as a person who travels a lot. Alone with the harp, I always think like, oh man, I wish I had a band family here. Like, oh, I'm driving past the Grand Canyon. Like, if I had, I don't want to go alone. If I had my band family here, then we could all like have this memory of going to see the Grand Canyon together and stuff. So I don't know. I feel like my career has been a lot of me just by myself in the car with the harp, kind of dreaming about being in a band and romanticizing it. But I also know that, you know, there can be problems too, for sure. But
only a few, just a few problems. I mean, driving past the Grand Canyon could be one of those problems. There could be a problematic moment though, when you think, look, they're all right near the edge.
Oh shit!
All I have to do.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Nobody would know. Nobody would know, and I'd have a solo career just like that. Ping.
We went 1 year, we were playing in Buffalo, you know, in upstate New York, and it was like very snowy, and we had a little time free, so we drove out to Niagara Falls. And at that time of year, because it's the middle of winter, there's nobody there, right? So we climbed over, and I will deny this if it ever goes to court, right? We climbed over the barrier get closer to the falls, you know, and take a photo for our Christmas card that year. And it ended up with a photo by our Christmas card. But it occurred to me after we got back, one false move, and half of us would have been, over the falls and dead.
Yeah.
Are we talking The Cure here, lol?
Yes.
Do you still have this card?
We won a copy of the card.
We want to see this card.
Yeah, I think I've got one somewhere.
Who was it? Robert? You, Robert?
Pearl, yeah. And Simon, yeah. And maybe Boris, I don't know. I think, Pearl drew some like little Santa hats on us on the photo and stuff, you know. So
isn't it funny? We might have been, you know, because the Banshees, Susie and the Banshees, I have photographs. I'm not in the photograph because I took the photograph underneath the falls.
Wow.
Underneath that little walkway underneath where rather than the what's called the Maid of the Mist goes sailing by. But you have to wear like a big yellow, like sou'wester on the head and a yellow cape. So you're completely yellow. So there's Susie Severin and Tuna and the tour manager. And who was the guitarist? I think it might have been John Carruthers. Yeah, I think so. Wasn't John McGee? Okay, I think it was.
I knew it was called John.
It was definitely John. Anyway,
you guys were wearing yellow capes.
No, I wasn't. I was being cool, but I wasn't in the photograph, so you would not have known. No, I probably was because it's soaking down there. It's like just millions of gallons of water flowing over your head, but it's just like you're just covered in spray. So that photograph turned up in the only book of the Banshees. I got some photographs in that, and that's one of them.
Amazing.
These are the happy memories, you know, sharing those moments with somebody.
Yeah, and you will always have them.
You know, I realized that when the band stopped and when Susie and I also split, that I found myself quite at a loss of what to do or where to go, but kind of, how do I do this, you know? Because I'd been in a band or been in a team or been in a marriage and a partnership for so long. But I do remember going to meet some people. There was a conference in, it was actually in Saint-Tropez, I think, because I lived in the southwest of France there. And so I jumped in a car and drove myself to Saint-Tropez. And there was the most beautiful moonrise over the Mediterranean. And I was on the roof of the hotel. And my first thought was either get on the phone or run downstairs and grab somebody, you know, whoever I was with. But I wasn't. I was totally on my own. And I think for the first time, I thought, just be here. Just be here and watch the moon and marvel at the beauty of it. I may have talked to somebody about it later, but I think it was almost the first time I was aware of, you know, just me and nobody else to run out and go, quick, come and see this. There are moments when you're with everybody and you find a moment alone, but I suppose it was like that significant for me because it was the first time I didn't feel lonely, but I understood to be alone. So maybe that feeds in to the music.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah.
That's actually the point where I felt like I'd finally figured some things out, when I could be alone and not be lonely. Does that make sense? You know, because I was reading something in an interview that you did, Mary. You said something that I thought was very interesting and very true to my own experience, that it's like when you go on tour, you're going to lots of different places and having different emotions. And a lot of your music was to capture those moments. And we talked about that before, like the melancholy, you know, I forget what the term was I said, but it's like a yearning for something happening, being there, and to travel and play music seems to ignite that, you know. And I know the Budgies told me things like that he's felt in places. And perhaps you could discuss about that for us, how it works in your new record.
Yeah, I don't know. I definitely feel like the songs that I make are like little diary entries, and maybe putting them out there in the world, like on a record or whatever, is a way of feeling less alone. You know, I like to describe it as like putting out my E.T. finger. You know how E.T. has that glowing finger and like is reaching out for a connection?
Oh,
you know? Yeah, totally. And I just feel like making music for me, and like making recorded music or even playing live for people, is kind of like my way of connecting with other weirdo loners, sad girls, you know, think people that are maybe feeling the same way, and who carry around a little bit of melancholy. I think it's like a kindred spirit kind of thing, you know.
I like that thing of, you say other people out there, because sometimes an audience can be a lot of couples or people together, but there are sometimes audiences where everybody's on their own. I know people who don't like to go to the cinema with anybody else or go to a concert. They want to go on their own because they don't want to be disturbed. They don't want to, they want to be focused on what's going on. And yet, if everybody is doing that, they are together. Apart, they're creating the experience with you.
Yeah. And even when you're in a couple and you're watching a show, you're still alone. You're still like by yourself processing it in your mind, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Ultimately, we are all alone.
I grew up playing classical music. I studied classical music really seriously through college. And at one point I thought it was going to be like an orchestral harpist. But then, you know, upon being in Thurston's band, writing parts for the record, that kind of led into, okay, we're just going to improvise, you know, for a while in this key or whatever, this like zone of notes. And I was like, well, I've never done that before. You know, I don't know how to do that. And he's also one of the greatest improvisers in history, you know? So I'm like, that's kind of an intimidating situation. But when someone like that tells you that the notes, that the sounds that you're choosing to make from your brain, your vulnerable, most vulnerable music brain, that sounds cool, then it kind of gives you more confidence to keep doing it. And I really attribute that to any kind of improvisation that I do now. I'm like,
wow,
that's, I learned that from being in that band for sure.
Well, that's amazing that you learned that. Cause my sister, you know, she was trained classically as well, and she can't, to my knowledge, you know, improvise at all. You know, if she does mm-hmm. try to improvise, you go, oh yeah, that's the Beatles you've just done. And that's, and she's a much better, you know, much better keyboard player than me. You know, you can stick anything in front of her and she can play it and that, but she can't improvise. So, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, maybe you've bridged the gap then, because you're able to do both sides, which is great.
Yeah. I mean, I had to unlearn, which, I mean, you know, you have that voice in your head that is telling you that you're playing it wrong or something. You have to push that voice away.
Was that your mother's voice? Was that your mother's voice in your head? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my teachers, all my teachers.
Yes, and your teacher. Yeah.
And all the other harpists who were like, you're playing it wrong. You know, like it's kind of intense to go to school for music in that way, because you know, you beat yourself up a lot.
Yeah.
But then, you know, then you have this freedom on the other side of the learning to let it go. And the freedom is the best thing in the world, you know, when you learn that there are no wrong notes, that you can just do whatever you want.
There are no wrong notes.
Yeah.
Yes, there are no wrong notes. And me and Budgie had the perfect thing, because we had the perfect instrument, because our instrument's so loud that we couldn't hear anybody who said to us we were playing it wrong. And if they did, we could throw something at them and it would stop. So
true.
Yeah, perfect.
You had stuff to throw.
Yeah, had stuff to throw.
You thought that was wrong. Get a load of this. You'd think the opposite would be the case. You'd think that with all this knowledge and all this vast history to choose from, that you've studied and you've nurtured and you've absorbed, that you just kind of throw it out there. But no, I worked with orchestras, and the conductor or somebody has said, okay, this part, we just need the brass section to just kind of riff on. And they go, what do you mean? And they're getting a bit like kind of nervous, and they're sweating, you know. And then one of them, they'll kind of just walk away.
Oh yeah,
we don't do that. Uh-huh. We don't riff. Do that.
Yeah,
and I was amazed. I thought, really? Oh, and it's the first time I'd realized that there was a difference. There's something different about, I don't know what it is. The ability to just stand up and just be vulnerable, allow something to happen, and you're not sure what's going to come next.
Yeah.
Even within the restriction of a band, pop band, mm-hmm. I think somebody like The Doors maybe were the first I was aware where there was song structure, but the song structure could really change because the singer decided it was going to change.
Yeah.
And the band was so interpretive, that skillful, knowledgeable of the way Morrison was in that example, they would just flip it. I could just change. And that ability must be really exciting being in the audience at that as well. But also wonderful to be in a band that can do that. Because many bands get into that album syndrome, you know, where you're recreating everything note for note as was recorded. And more today, that seems to be what people require, is I want to hear that song exactly.
Right.
As you recorded it. And you go, I can't remember it. Where should we go next, Mary? What's on your mind today?
Let's talk about Lowell playing on my record.
Oh, okay.
He played a beautiful part.
I heard it last night.
Did you?
How did that come about? You and Lowell have done a collaboration on Mary on your new album, which is called, tell me again.
Just called Goodbye Hotel Arcata.
I love that title.
You do? Thank you.
Yeah.
The title comes from this hotel that I have been to. I didn't stay there, but I took a walk around it in this little town in Croatia that I like. And this was before its renovation, when a friend of mine who lives there was like, you know, say goodbye to Hotel Arcata. It's not going to be the same when you get back. And then it got renovated. I've been looking at it on the internet and stuff. It looks like a nice renovation, but, you know, it's still, you know, I think the theme of the record is like nothing will ever be the same again, you know, for better or for worse. It just, the record has a lot of, I don't know, I guess it has 6 songs. It has a lot of guests on it, which is such a delight. I haven't really had guests.
And Lol comes in on Arrivederci.
Yeah.
Mary sent me the track and I thought, wow, it sounds very evocative to me, you know, which is what I think a lot of your music does. Because I mean, I was familiar with, like, you know, Hundreds of Days and stuff, and things I'd listened to that I loved. And but it's always very evocative. It's got a place in mind. And so it sounded like that. So I thought, well, that was the first thing when I, you know, turned on the machines. That's what I want to do. I don't want to crowd it out, but I want to add to that and bring that forward. And luckily you liked it. So there you go. It was very nice to do.
Yeah, it's perfect. I don't know if I told you this, but I had a party on New Year's Eve and I got your part on New Year's Eve. I think you sent it to me and I just like retreated into my room away from the party and I listened to it and I was just smiling my face off. I was just like, I don't know. It's a great way to start the new year, you know, like in this personal space.
Now you're making me blush.
What do you do, Mary, when you've got, when you have that moment and you're enjoying it, and how do you, if you like, bring it to a close rather than it be, like, everything, some things maybe reach conclusion somehow quickly. It's a quick moment, but some things build over a long time.
Yeah.
In my experience.
Yeah.
So how do you know, do we fade? Do you edit?
That's a good question. This one, I definitely faded in. Because there was stuff in the beginning, and you fade out sometimes, but also I definitely have had 10-minute songs, 13-minute songs, you know, just like relentless jam band style,
right?
But also I guess I have a problem with that, with the length sometimes, but I feel like if people truly connect with what I'm making, then they're not looking for a 2-minute pop song. They kind of know what they're getting into a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Brian Eno, there's a quote from him somewhere in an interview, which was like, talking through, I think it's Another Green World. It's probably one of the albums I played the most when I was, you know, I was at college. And a lot of the tracks fade in and fade out. And his idea was that the music is like, always going,
yeah,
and you just happen to visit it.
I love that.
It was, rather than the track fading in and out, it was like we as listeners,
yeah,
we join it.
Oh, beautiful.
So it really is a much nicer way, isn't it, that you could just open a door, go amazing,
yeah,
and then quietly close it so you don't disturb it.
I love it.
Or you go into the room and spend a lot of time listening. I saw a thing, one of those things you see of yourself, you know, there's me, Susie and Severin arriving in Leicester Square for the premiere of Batman Returns, right? We'd spent all year doing the one song that was not created by Danny Elfman on his own. So we'd done this collaboration and Danny DeVito as the Penguin.
Oh, yeah.
Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman. Michael Keaton's Batman. And what an astounding cast. And anyway, so I thought, I've got to arrive in style. And I'm reminded, because the shot I see is of me with this coat of many colors, looking like, you know, out of a musical. It's a Pam Hall creation for the night.
Right.
And I've got a glass of champagne in my hand. And that's the shot that I hadn't seen before. So I'm going, oh my God, it's true. I thought I remembered the champagne in the car. I thought, no, I invented that. So I realized that I'm probably a bit happy when I get out of the car. And that's why I'm smiling and I'm carrying like my CD of Batman Returns, whatever. And I meet the guy out of Spinal Tap in the foyer, you know, with the mustache, the black mustache that goes like that, you know. And I go like, oh my God, you're here. And I'm saying, when are you playing next? And I'm, because I am, you know, thinking I'm just meeting the guy. And he just looks at me like I'm absurd, of course. You know? And I think it gets a little bit worse, because I think I did then meet Tim Burton and said, like, after the film had run, and said, yeah, but what happened at that? There was a bit of a mix-up in the edit, wasn't there? There was like a jump. This is not the thing you said to the director of the film after you were just like, no.
Oh, no.
But I was just being honest. I was only giving him, not my opinion, but just, you know, my thoughts. I don't think he would have taken me too seriously. I was probably not in the, you know, really dressed the way I was, looking the way I was probably not to be taken seriously. No harm meant.
What did his face look like when you said that?
We had the most amazing experience. We were flown over, like, on Virgin upper class, you know, so high up in the plane, we were on top of it, you know. We were in the rarefied atmosphere outside the captain's thing. And we were holed up in, like, that the Bel Air Hotel, you know, the big pink one. But the one, and every day a car came to pick us up and took us around to, like, Warner Brothers back lot. And we were invited in when Tim Burton was pulling the rushes through one of those, you know, machines where you do it by hand. And he was, like, pulling stuff through this machine. He'd go, watching Batman Returns being built.
Wow.
It was incredible, you know. And we were just there just to talk about the song that we might be able to write and create for this film that was happening. But it was just, you know, almost more magical than the film itself in a way. The film was amazing, you know. It was amazing, the style of it all. It was just to be in that world for a brief moment and realize that our part was so minuscule, and perhaps everybody's part is, like, you know, a part of the whole. The whole thing is so huge. The closest I could see now is probably, you know, the Star Wars things or Barbie, where it's colossal production things. But to see the man with all the ideas and all the drawings and all the imagination at this rickety old machine, like, pulling it through, you know.
Oh, I love it.
Great sound. What an experience. I mean, that's all I need to tell my children about when I grow really old and they sit on my knee and go, I remember the time I was sitting with Timothy Burton and he was pulling the film through. They go, Daddy, what's film?
Well, when you see someone at the, you know, at their doing their thing and it's so personal and they're just by, you know, doing the actual work and you watch it, I feel like that's like a private personal moment. That's such a gem to be able to witness. It's really amazing when that, you know, the cameras are off and, you know, no one's filming them. They don't have to put on any face. This is just like them doing their actual work. It's like a rare gift.
I had a bit of a terrifying experience at the only film premiere that I think we did as The Cure. We made that film in Orange, the concert film, you know, and it was shown on, you know, 70 millimeter in Leicester Square, some huge great cinema. And our seats for the premiere were right at the very front. So we were all lying, like, you know, backwards.
Oh my God.
On our backs, looking up at this gigantic thing, you know, and then you'd see, you know, your head suddenly it appear like 30 foot high in front of you. That was very disconcerting.
Wow.
Very disconcerting.
That's cool.
Is that why people like to put their heads around the door in sound check? Not because they want to see you like 30 foot high on the screen, but they want to see what you do when you're not on show, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always do the same thing for that reason. I go through my whole life doing exactly what you see on stage or in videos. I just do the whole that. That's all I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is nice, though. Isn't it nice when you walk into a theater and somebody's rehearsing a line or somebody's tuning up and you realize it's like, it's that person, you know, who's playing tonight.
Yeah. I mean, I had that with Neil Halstead. He produced my last record from Slowdive.
Yeah.
you know, I just flew there, not really knowing him at all, but just being a huge fan. And, you know, watching him play guitar on my song and hearing that his guitar sound that was so embedded in my brain and heart, you know, and my makeup, I think, like, just to watch him do that, like, tears are streaming down my face. I don't know, I'm kind of a sentimental person, but just to hear that sound, like, so personally, you know, I think it kind of reminds me of, did you ever see Prince? Well, this is different, I guess, but, you know, someone at the height of their power, or, like, totally in control of their power and their thing, like Prince playing at the Super Bowl, I think, you know, you could just see it in his face that he has the confidence to just know what he's doing and to just execute it, even when the rain starts. And I guess, like, someone comes on and says, Prince, what do you want to do? It's raining really hard. Do you want to stop playing? And he says, make it rain harder. You know, and then he plays Purple Rain. It's just, I feel like just being a fan and appreciating what people do in their when they're in their power is, like, it's really remarkable. It makes you really appreciate human beings when they can be so horrible sometimes.
Yes. The cynic in me says that somewhere, you know, Prince had one of those airplanes that seeds the clouds to fly above, you know, like, that's when you drop the rain cloud stuff. And then I come on and say, you know, do you want to carry on? He goes, yes, let it rain more, you know.
He did orchestrate everything. He was in control of a lot, but.
He had a word with God. Before he went on, he said a little prayer. He went, God, okay, this is about 4 minutes in. 4 minutes in, and then you can think.
I'm sure people thought that the year we played Glastonbury, and it was like pouring with rain, absolutely pouring with rain. And we went on stage, and it stopped. And the green laser that comes out from the back and hits Glastonbury Tor, you could see it, you know, shining through all these little raindrops that were just dripping down and stuff. Oh, and that's where we started, you know, and I was like, yeah, thank you. Thank you, big fella,
heaven,
for making it happen. Yeah.
Had some shows in my yard in the pandemic, very distanced, where we, you know, the first show that I hosted in the garden was like eight guests, and we just hadn't heard live music in over a year. You know, all the clubs were closed down, all of the touring musicians were just kind of stopped in our tracks. And so I said, what if, so I have this friend Walt McClements, he plays the accordion through effects, so he improvises. It's like this beautiful, colorful, saturated, drone-y accordion style that he has. And it just hits your heart so deeply. And so I asked him to come and play on the porch while we sort of sat distanced in the yard. And I played a little set, but he played the first set. And to hear live music, to hear someone playing music, you know, right there with you after a year and a half of not, I mean, that stopped me in my tracks. I think everyone was crying there, you know, just to hear the power of that and to just feel that again was really magical.
Yeah.
Walt is also, he's also on my record too, my new one.
Yes, so, I noticed.
You can kind of hear his style. Yeah.
That's a wonderful, wonderful image, I think.
My moment would be Lou Reed playing in London, and he was playing Berlin, apparently for the first time since it.
Oh my God.
And so, and they had the little children on stage from the local school, and it was late. And I was with, I don't think we were married then, but it was the lady who's now my wife and mother of my children. So it's my, and probably maybe her first rock concert, because she was also a classically trained pianist and hadn't been to many rock concerts. So I thought, Lou Reed, Berlin. And I was just, I suppose it's an album that moves me deeply, but to see the man himself many years later, and he had his guitarist from the album playing the solos that only he could play, I suppose. The most amazing, wow. Most amazing concert.
Wow.
And then he finished with all the hits, you know, Like, oh, perfect, man. Perfect day, and walk on the wild side, and
the best.
It's like crazy. We're all crying, I think.
My moment was I took Gray, my son, when he was 10, to see UCLA at Royce Hall to see the Kodo drummers, you know, and we were like third row, you know, and the curtains opened and there's this gigantic drum on like a railway cart on the middle of the stage with this man just in a, you know, like a loincloth with these two sticks that are like small trunks playing this huge drum about 10 foot in front of Gray. And it was amazing. I mean, I was bowled over and I watched Gray's face, you know, it was just like, wow. You know, it was just very, very powerful. And I like that whole concert was great, how you can get so much out. You know, I play drums, you know, the idea of a 2-hour drum concert, even to me, is like, maybe it'll be something, you know, I want to change something a little bit, but it didn't. You know, it was great. They could just, you know, they could make everything uh-huh. with it. So I was, that was one of my favorites, I think.
Wow. That is cool. I've never seen anything like that.
They destroy theaters, Kodo. They did. Oh. They used to come to Sadler's Wells in London every year, and more plaster would fall from the proscenium every time.
Right. Yeah, I could believe it. I could believe it. It was kind of amazing.
I'm excited to hear Gray play. I'm taking Gray on tour.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you are. Yeah. Well, you know, he'll be excited to hear your stories traveling as well. I know he will.
Oh, yeah. I just bought a new car yesterday.
Okay.
A van.
Good.
That is going to drive us around. So I'm really excited about this new car. I do have 60 months of car payments, which is a long time, but it's a nice minivan. It's going to hold the harp. It's going to hold anything else, luggage, all that, the instruments. So necessary.
So now you know where Gray's going to be for the next 60 months, lol.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Paying off my debt.
Yeah. There's the dog. The dog obviously wants to get going somewhere. Should we take our cue? It's just so lovely meeting you, and I can't wait until we meet in person.
Yes, I love the record. Thank you for involving me, and thank you for inviting me on the podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for making it a magic moments on our little album. It's lovely. Thank you. Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jack Knife Lee.
Assistant editor, Ben Miller. Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.